Before we go on to our next speaker, a couple of quick follow-up comments to the discussion with Dr. Sarter. The autologous cellular immunotherapeutic treatment, Cepulucil-T, has now been approved for the treatment of asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic castrate-resistant hormone-refractory prostate cancer, and at ASCO, we saw survival data for CALGB-90401 comparing docetaxel and prednisone with and without bevacizumab. And while there was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival and post-therapy PSA decline, there was no improvement in the primary trial endpoint of overall survival. Finally, at ASCO, the TROPIC trial was reported, comparing mitoxantrone prednisone to carbazitaxel, as discussed by Dr. Sarter, in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer previously treated with docetaxel, and the median overall survival was 12.7 months for the mitoxantrone group versus 15.1 months for the carbazitaxel group, with a hazard ratio of 0.70, which was statistically significant. I next met with Dr. Nancy Dawson, and for the beginning of our conversation, I asked her to go through some of the major points she and co-author Dr. Kieran Lassie wanted to make in the May 2010 review article published in Current Opinion in Oncology, focusing on the challenging issue of management of men with prostate cancer resistant to androgen deprivation.
Overall, when I look at castrate-resistant prostate cancer, I'm looking at where you are in the course of your disease. So if a patient has just failed initial hormonal therapy, they may or may not even have metastatic disease. So they could be PSA-only castrate-resistant prostate cancer, or they could actually have metastases. And so I look at castrate-resistant prostate cancer as sort of a spectrum of diseases that sort of goes through this initial period of time where it's hormone responsive still before it becomes truly castrate-resistant. So when I'm thinking about the new drugs that are in development or the new tools that we have, I look at it actually thinking about a patient and how I would treat them and when I would fit something in. So if I have a patient who has just failed initial hormonal therapy and they're asymptomatic, they may or may not have metastases, I'm going to be looking for something new in the second line hormonal therapy area, or I'll be looking for an immunotherapy because the patients, you know, are not really sick at that time. So that would be where drugs like abiraterone, which is a drug somewhat similar to ketoconazole but a lot more potent, would come in, another oral agent. That's also the sort of area where a therapy like Provenge would come in. Those would sort of fit in that asymptomatic, minimally metastatic, castrate-resistant part of the spectrum. And then when you think about new drugs in development, new therapies on the horizon, you then actually get to your truly what we used to call androgen-independent disease. And that's where you're going to be looking for new taxanes like cabazitaxel. That's where that kind of drug would fit in. And just sort of backtracking a little bit, a drug like ZD4054, now known as zibotentan, again, another oral drug, that would also be a drug that would fit into the sort of middle spectrum of the disease in patients who are relatively asymptomatic with usually bone metastases only. So I usually actually think about the disease when I'm thinking of new therapies, actually how I treat the disease. And then the tools, you know, we're all sort of disappointed in PSA because it often is not helpful, for example, in patients who are getting docetaxel for their castrate-resistant prostate cancer. One of the things that we see is that the PSA may go actually up before it goes down, and so you don't really know whether the patient is responding or not during the first couple of cycles. And so that's where I start thinking about things like circulating tumor cells as a new tool that might be a little bit more accurate earlier in the treatment course to know whether someone is responding or not.
And, you know, this paper really goes through all these things in a very concise way. And really, congratulations. It's really a great resource. Maybe we can pick up on some of the things that are brought up that you just mentioned in the paper. And the first, I guess, would be secondary endocrine therapy. And one of the things that you mentioned is abiraterone. Can you explain what that is and what else is being developed right now in terms of other means of endocrine therapy?
Well, abiraterone is an oral drug, and it suppresses basically all forms of androgen. So it suppresses not only testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, it suppresses the adrenal androgens as well. and it's felt to be, you know, 10 times more potent than ketoconazole. Ketoconazole, for example, doesn't really lower your testosterone as much as abiraterone. Abiraterone can get your testosterone level down to less than 1. The other thing that it does that no other drug that we have available now does is it actually really lowers the androgens in tissue. So there was a very interesting correlative science study done out of MD Anderson where they actually did bone marrow biopsies on patients being treated with abiraterone. They could show that the androgen levels in the bone marrow tissue actually declined and correlated with the patients who responded to abiraterone. So it's sort of like your top of the line, you know, if it's an androgen, it suppresses it. And the thing about castrate-resistant prostate cancer is part of the reason, or one of the hypotheses is the one that I think most people believe in, is the fact that patients become probably hypersensitive to low levels of androgen, and that's why their disease is sort of breaking through. And so if you can do something to better suppress androgen and do it sort of, you know, all across the board, you're going to get a better response, or you'll get a second response that you didn't, even though the patient is already on an LHRH analog.
And actually, the breast cancer clinical investigators have been talking about that for years. They kind of talk about resetting the estrostat. You know, these patients get aromatase inhibitors and they're super sensitive, et cetera. It kind of sounds similar to what you're describing.
Yeah, it is similar to that.
And so there's no point then in giving an LHRH agonist plus abiraterone.
Well, the studies that were done in castrate-resistant prostate cancer, patients were continued on their LHRH analog because most of us believe that you should do that. But the point that you bring up is an interesting one, which is the question of, well, do you actually have to do that? Could you just treat someone with abiraterone even earlier in the disease as, you know, new metastatic disease or just even someone who's at high risk for recurrence? Could you just give them abiraterone? And that's an area of future development.
What about side effects and toxicity issues with abiraterone?
Abiraterone is extremely well tolerated. I don't mean to say it has no potential side effects, but it really has very minimal to no side effects.
And where are things right now in its development? Is it likely to become available?
It was going through some phase 3 trials, and the last of the trials is an abiraterone versus placebo trial. And that trial is still open, but it's anticipated that all the trials will be completed, and it should theoretically, assuming it's approved and everything goes as planned, be available next year, 2011.
Interesting. Now, another issue discussed in your paper that you mentioned is the endothelin receptor antagonists or antagonists, because the one, I guess, that I've heard the most about that you talk about in this paper is 4054, or I guess now it's called zibotentan.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? And I know you've had a couple of papers recently looking at that, one from the Journal of Cancer Research and Clinical Oncology and the Journal of the European Association of Urology. Can you summarize what we know about this agent and what it is?
All right. Well, zibotentan is an endothelin receptor antagonist, and it's very specific for endothelin receptor A. And that's important because A and B do slightly different things, and sometimes actually being antagonistic against endothelin receptor B actually could be not beneficial. It could actually not do what you wanted. And so this is exclusively an antagonist against endothelin receptor A. That's to sort of differentiate it from atrasentan, which predominantly is an antagonist against endothelin receptor A, but is not specific.
And can you just backtrack a little bit in terms of what these receptors actually are? What is their function?
Well, they're involved with progression of cancer. They're specifically important in bone. They're involved in nociception and pain. So they're important in pain, and they're important in what they refer to as that vicious cycle in bone, where things like in prostate cancer specifically, where tumor cells go to bone, sort of like dig their own little hole there and create their own food supply. And so, you know how you think of bisphosphonates interfering with that vicious cycle? Well, endothelin receptors are also involved in the progression of cancer in bone.
Now, this is in the normal stroma or in the tumor cells?
This is in the normal stroma. And so you're actually, you're affecting more the milieu that the cancer cells arrive in. So actually the endothelin, you know, drugs like zibotentan have actually been combined with drugs like Zometa. And actually together they do more than either of them alone in trying to decrease the progression of bone metastases in tumor models.
And these are small molecules?
Yes, they're small.
But they're not TKIs.
No, these are not TKIs.
And what about, before you get into the efficacy, what about side effects and tolerability?
These drugs give you a little mild case of the flu. You get a runny nose. You can get a little bit of edema, a little bit of fatigue, but it's a runny nose type side effect.
And it's a once-a-day oral preparation.
Right, right.
And I guess it was called ZD-4054.
Right.
I just heard about the new name here, so it sounds a little bit more, you know, interesting, I guess.
Well, usually, you know, that's the sort of clue that one has about where a drug is in development.
Right.
You know, as soon as they give it a little catchy name like that, that means
right.
that they think it might be FDA approved in the future.
Right. Because this, I mean, it's pretty recent that this name came out. I don't remember seeing it.
It was a few months ago.
A few months ago.
Not that
okay.
many months ago.
Right. Is there any patient that you treated with this agent that had a clinical course that, you know, was typical of what you observed in that trial that you could maybe chat about?
Not really.
I guess you didn't know who was getting it, really. Was that placebo?
Yeah.
Right. So you didn't know. So the trial itself was placebo controlled. Could you figure out who was on it based on nasal congestion or anything, or not really?
Well, you know, I mean, nasal congestion, if you think about it, they say people have colds 3 times a year at least. So, I mean, you sort of have an idea who might be getting it, but, you know, not always sure. And because it's not affecting the PSA and didn't really affect, you know, progression-free survival, I actually try not to think too much about, you know, who's getting it, who isn't getting it. We're trying to have an impact on something more, in other words, overall survival. But when we first did the study, it's pretty well tolerated.
Okay, so what do we know in terms of efficacy of zibotentan?
Well, the only trial that is actually completed and published is the randomized phase 2 trial. And it was placebo versus 2 different doses of zibotentan.
This is the one from the European Association of Urology,
right.
Mm-hmm. right? And who was eligible for the study?
They were patients with that same group, with bone metastases, relatively asymptomatic. They weren't allowed to be on narcotics. So they were basically metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer, but you had to have bone metastases and you had to be relatively asymptomatic. Minimally asymptomatic.
And what was seen?
Well, what was seen is that the patients who received the zibotentan had a, at least on the analysis that are in print there, had a improvement in overall survival of about 7 months. But that's a randomized phase 2 trial. So obviously survival is not the primary endpoint. But they did follow these patients when they saw at the first analysis an unexpected improvement in overall survival because they did not see an improvement in progression-free survival, which was the primary endpoint. So they extended the trial to longer follow-up to see if this effect on overall survival was in fact true. And they were inspired by the results of this trial to go on to do some phase 3 trials, which are – there's a phase 3 trial that's similar – versus placebo, similar to the randomized phase 2, but there's only, you know, 1 dose of zibotentan versus placebo. And then they also have a trial of docetaxel with or without ZD-4054. And so these trials are, some of them at least, there's actually 3 trials. We still don't have the results of these phase 3 trials. One of them is still going on. And it's hoped that we'll have results probably next year. So this is a drug that if you were going to project, you're probably looking at over a year for now, for sure, before it would be a drug that would be available.
Any speculations on how this is going to all play out?
Well, I'm optimistic. You know, I think that this is an important target, and I think the results of the randomized phase 2 are very promising. If you start looking at this drug, some of the preclinical work being done with some other new drugs that are being developed that actually work at that vicious cycle in bone, there are some sort of experimental preclinical research showing that they were actually able to prevent the development of, you know, they took a model that was normally developing bone metastases, prostate cancer model, and they could actually show that certain combinations that they developed actually completely prevented the development of bone metastases during the interval that they were doing the study.
I guess most of these patients, or if not all of them, actually would be on bisphosphonates just clinically, correct?
Right. They would probably be on a bisphosphonate. So you can imagine that this could work well with a bisphosphonate.
But, I mean, in a way, it's kind of looking at the combination, although it's not randomized, but since they're on the – and you mentioned there might be some synergy there.
Right. And so there's going to obviously this stratification, you know, for whether you're on or not on a bisphosphonate.
Now, getting back to the issue of tolerability, and I see here in the paper the same issues that you were just talking about, the nasal congestion, et cetera. It's kind of interesting in terms of, I guess, why it happens. But you also had another paper in the journal Cancer Research and Clinical Oncology looking at quality of life and symptoms in patients on this agent. Can you kind of summarize what you saw there?
Well, I guess the bottom line is that most patients continued to have a reasonably good quality of life throughout the course of the study. So there was very minimal change in quality of life. And there was no difference in quality of life change between whether you got the zibotentan or you got the placebo. So certainly these patients were not suffering from any significant toxicities associated with the drug.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a refreshing change in terms of systemic therapy. Another issue discussed in the paper is new cytotoxic agents. And of course, cabazitaxel was presented at the GU meeting a couple of months ago. And actually, Oliver Sartor is on the same program discussing that. But I am curious about your take on the data about this agent in general.
Well, I guess my take would be that I think cabazitaxel, which I understand is being fast-tracked to be approved, I think it will take up a space after Taxotere. I think it's going to become a standard. It doesn't really have any competition in that area. I mean, unless, of course, abiraterone, you could use abiraterone after Taxotere as well as before. But I see it as becoming a standard therapy. So you get docetaxel, and when that doesn't work, you get cabazitaxel. I think the only question that people will raise, and since all we've seen is the presentation, you know, at a meeting, you know, we obviously haven't seen the full paper and the full analysis, is getting a better feeling for the patients who had been off docetaxel for a longer period of time, because they had groups of patients. They had patients who progressed on Taxotere, patients who progressed less than 3 months after Taxotere, and those who progressed more than 3 months. And so the question comes up, is the group that progressed more than, you know, 3 months after Taxotere, couldn't you have just given them Taxotere again? Were they really taxane resistant? And I think that's where the questions about the trial, where I'd like to see a little bit more analysis and to get a feeling for, because right now, if you have a patient who responded to docetaxel and they progress several months later, you're likely to retreat them with docetaxel. And like one of the patients that I had talked to you about, not in this interview, but previously, you're expecting that they'll probably respond to retreatment with docetaxel. So you don't really think that they're resistant at that point in time. So that was my only concern about where it's going to take up its position.
Have you had any patients on this agent?
No, I wasn't in that trial.
And what's your understanding in terms of side effects and tolerability of this agent, for example, compared to docetaxel? I know it hasn't been compared head-to-head, but what about indirectly?
I didn't see any toxicities that seemed unusual. I mean, it's a cytotoxic. It had cytotoxic-type toxicities that we're all sort of familiar with as far as, you know, myelosuppression. And so I didn't feel it was more or less toxic just based on the data that was presented.
No. What about docetaxel? Any new research there, data? I know that there were interest in trying to look at it in earlier stage disease, PSA-only disease, and high-risk disease. Anything new that we've learned about this agent?
I haven't seen anything, at least, you know, there's several studies going on, as you know, like in newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. There's a, you know, hormonal therapy plus or minus docetaxel. There's been several phase two clinical trials looking at it early on in high-risk patients. There aren't any phase three trial results out there that I have seen. CLGB right now has a docetaxel or no docetaxel before prostatectomy study. So there's several phase three trials. I mean, it's gotten to phase three trials, but nothing has made it to prime time.
Another thing that you mentioned in here, but I think at the time that you wrote this paper, we probably didn't have any data, is the issue of targeting the tumor vasculature. And we've all had our fingers crossed for a while about bevacizumab, which was looked at with docetaxel. And although nothing's been presented, I guess there's a press release or some announcement out there regarding that. Maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the phase three trial was based on a phase two trial done also in the CALGB, where it looked like the overall survival might be a little longer than seen with docetaxel alone. And so there was some promise there, but unfortunately, like many a phase three trial, when it actually got tested in the phase three setting, there was no improvement in overall survival with the addition of bevacizumab to docetaxel compared to docetaxel alone.
I thought I heard something, maybe progression-free survival, or there was something about it. I can't remember what it was that was sort of positive. Is anything, are you aware of anything?
I haven't seen the formal analysis because they've kept that pretty much under wraps, but it's my understanding that they're going to be presenting it at ASCO.
Right. I mean, do you think that this is going to be the end of looking at it in prostate cancer?
I'm not sure if it's the end, but I'm not feeling that it probably should be pursued. In my mind, I think that we need to move to other things. There's enough new therapies that need to be looked at, and we have enough trouble putting people on clinical trials. I think we should try to focus getting our patients on trials that are more likely to be useful and give us a good endpoint.
I got to say, maybe I'm the eternal optimist or something, but I was kind of surprised by the press release. You know, we've seen, it's not like necessarily earth-shattering data, but we have seen positive data in breast cancer, colon
right.
cancer, lung cancer, renal cell, ovary. You know, I kind of was surprised. And, you know, I also wonder about the whole issue of just trying to study agents in prostate cancer, but the trials themselves seem very tough to do.
Well, actually, that particular kind of trial is relatively easy to do. I think the trial that's easiest to recruit to is a standard plus or minus. And so, you know, I've treated several patients on that clinical trial, and I found that it was actually a relatively easy trial to enroll to. And as you know, Avastin, you know, obviously there's some serious toxicities that have been seen with, you know, like bowel perforation. But the vast majority of patients who are on Avastin, it's almost like they're not getting anything at all. So it doesn't add a lot of toxicity.
Let's talk about your cases, starting out with the 70-year-old man.
Okay, well, the first case that I thought was interesting, and by the way, all of these patients are actually currently under my care. So the first gentleman, a 70-year-old gentleman, was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2002. At the time, he had a Gleason 8 and a PSA of 25. So although he appeared to have localized disease, he had high risk localized disease, and he was treated with radiation and androgen deprivation therapy. And based on his high risk, he actually stayed on androgen deprivation therapy. I normally would treat him for at least 3 years, and in his case, we continued him on until 2006 when his PSA started to elevate.
Just out of curiosity, was this complete androgen blockade or just an LHRH analog?
Just an LHRH analog.
Okay.
And then in 2006, his PSA started to rise. And I treated him with my favorite second-line hormonal therapy, which is ketoconazole and hydrocortisone. And that actually worked for a while. His PSA did drop down to 0.8, but then again, it started to rise. And he wasn't anxious to go on chemotherapy. His son's a cardiologist, and I had the whole family involved. And so I said, well, we could try some estrogen. And his abdomen started to swell and his legs started to swell. And we were thinking maybe this was from the estrogen. But in fact, we did a CT scan and he had ascites and he had some nodularity in his omentum. And I actually did a biopsy and it verified this was metastatic prostate cancer because his bone scan showed no metastases. So his only site of metastases was basically his omentum.
Yeah, I mean, when I heard about this story, the first thing I thought about was, did you biopsy him? Because it sounded so unusual. I mean, how often do you see this with these intra-abdominal mets and no bone mets?
Well, in the last couple of years, I've had two exactly like this.
Wow.
And what actually surprised me in both cases were how responsive the patients were to treatment. Because you're thinking of it like visceral metastases, but it's not. It's a different animal.
And when you tapped him, the acidic fluid had tumor cells in it too?
Yes, it did.
Wow. So what did you do at that point?
So I treated him with Taxotere. And, you know, we had a discussion about how long he should stay on it. His PSA was 7.3 when we started. And he continued on it. He got 24 cycles of Taxotere.
Wow.
And he had a complete remission.
Wow.
His CT scan became totally normal. And his nadir PSA was 0.2.
Seems like a kind of unusual story, not just the site of the mets, but the responsiveness.
Right. And as I said, I've had two patients who had ascites and omental metastases with no other metastases, and they both were very responsive to Taxotere.
Now, he's an older man. How did he tolerate it?
He did great. He's not had a single hospitalization. I did give him Neulasta, but he had no hospitalizations. He's continued to work full time. He still works full time. He travels a lot, has been on several trips. And now the other point that was interesting about him is that, you know, we stopped his Taxotere in July of 2009. And I said, I don't think I've cured you, but, you know, we agreed, you know, 24 cycles, that's a lot of chemotherapy. Let's take a break. And about in December of 2009, his PSA increased to 5.9, and I got another CAT scan, and there again, he had this mesentery inflammatory changes, which the radiologist called to tell me about because he thought he might have like diverticulitis. He said, I think this man may need an antibiotic. And I was thinking, no, I think he probably needs some chemotherapy. But he had the exact same recurrence. But at that time, he didn't have ascites. He was basically asymptomatic. And I restarted him on docetaxel. He's now had 7 cycles. His PSA is down to 1.4, and his CT scan is again normal.
Wow. I mean, this is a really good example of what you were saying about carbazitaxel, because I guess theoretically he could have gone into a trial carbazitaxel at the time you retreated him with the docetaxel.
Right, exactly. And you would have thought that, you know, he's not taxotere unresponsive. He's not resistant.
What a case. Any clues out there? You know, we talk about personalized oncology in terms of predictors of cases like this as opposed to other cases that don't respond as well, say, to docetaxel.
Well, in my experience, omental metastases do very well. The other group that seems to are the lymph node only patients. I've had several patients, you know, prostate cancer tends to metastasize to the left supraclavicular lymph node. So, and I've had several patients who came in with very high PSAs and, you know, extensive lymph node metastases, and they've also had very good long responses.
Well, this is really an amazing case.
And he's off traveling again.
Wow. Amazing.
We actually, you know, we sometimes have to work around his schedule.
Wow. Incredible. What about your 66-year-old man?
Well, my 66-year-old man, another patient who was diagnosed a relatively long time ago, he was diagnosed in 1998. And at the time, his MRI scan showed what looked like seminal vesicle involvement. So he was locally advanced. And he was put on a clinical trial up at Dana-Farber. He received TEC, you know, which is Taxol Estramustine Carboplatin. And he got that in combination with hormonal therapy and then went on to be treated with radiation. This was a CALGB trial that I also treated several patients on that regimen. And he did well for a while, but in November of 2004, he did have a biochemical recurrence. And at that time, he was treated with combined androgen blockade. So he got an LHRH analog and received Casodex. And he did well for about a year and a half. And then he became castrate resistant. And so we did what you're supposed to do. We stopped the Casodex, looking for an anti-androgen withdrawal. And in fact, his PSA did decline in response to stopping the Casodex. And actually, it stayed down for a while. It was another year before his PSA started to go up. And we did a metastatic workup. And that time, he clearly had bone metastases. He also had some adenopathy. And I treated him with ketoconazole and hydrocortisone. And we also started him on Zometa at that time, monthly Zometa, to avoid some of the skeletal morbidity from his bone metastases. He responded to ketoconazole and hydrocortisone, did well for another year and a half. And then he, again, had progression of his disease. And at that time, I enrolled him on a trial of Provenj, cipulucel T, and it was a trial that we were doing with 2 different doses, and he got his 3 infusions, and he just had some mild flu-like symptoms, you know, little muscle aches, some chills, no fever, lasted about 24 hours, and he got that every time he got his infusion. He got his 3 infusions. It did absolutely nothing to his PSA. His follow-up bone scan showed some new bone metastases, so it had no effect that you could see on his disease. But he understood that in advance, and so he was not expecting anything either. And now he's actually enrolled on a clinical trial at the NIH that they're doing with docetaxel, bevacizumab, lenalidomide, and prednisone. And they also put them on daily Lovenox because they've seen some increase in thrombotic events. He's doing very well. He's had 10 cycles, and he's had a response both in his measurable disease as well as a declining PSA, and he's tolerating it very well. His only other problem is that he did get ONJ from his Zometa earlier this year, and we had to stop the Zometa.
That's interesting. How did the ONJ present?
It presented with jaw pain.
Hmm.
He just, you know, said, my jaw is hurting, and they took some x-rays, and he had ONJ.
What did it look like visually?
Visually, you could see that there was a slight break in the gum, and it looked a little irritated. I've had probably about 4 or 5 patients with ONJ, and it's often, you know, complicating some dental work. after they've had a tooth extracted or worked on, and it tends to look like necrotic tissue just sort of sitting on top of a socket.
How did you manage it?
The patients actually go on antibiotics, and I usually get a dentist involved with it. You really should find a dentist who's got a lot of experience in this area. They do some sort of dental procedure, at least some of the patients I've had, where they actually cover the socket with some sort of material.
Is this a dentist or oral surgeon?
I've sent them to dentists. In the area where I am, there's a particular dentist who has an interest, and I've sent him several patients.
Now, how long was he on the zoledronic acid at the time this happened?
Let's see. He would have been on it over a year. I started it in April of 07, and this was January of 10. So 2.5 years.
That's not like a hugely long period of time. So you stopped the zoledronic acid. What happened to his pain?
Oh, his pain is gone now. And really, he's fine, but I'm not anxious to give it to him again. You know, the way drugs like Zometa work, it gets in the bone. It's going to be in his bone for a long time. So I certainly don't want to re-challenge him.
The trolleys one is really interesting. I guess you really don't know which of the, it could just be the docetaxel that's having the benefit. But lenalidomide is really an amazing agent. We first started hearing about it in myeloma, and now we're hearing about all the lymphomas. It seems like nobody really understands how it works. And I guess there were some encouraging data in prostate cancer that had come out previously.
Right. They had done the same trial, but instead of lenalidomide, they used thalidomide.
Right.
And, you know, if you looked at the waterfall plot, you know, almost everybody responded, which is phenomenal. Looking over their results compared to the other phase two trials that were presented at ASCO at the same time, their results looked better than anybody's. So I've sent several patients to them for this trial.
But now this is lenalidomide alone or with chemo?
With chemo. The trial that they presented previous was docetaxel, bevacizumab, thalidomide, prednisone.
Right.
And their responses, they had over a 90% response, if I recall.
Yeah, but it's interesting, though, that they've got bevacizumab in there, and yet, as you mentioned, you have this discouraging data that came out. It's going to be interesting if it turns out that, you know, this cocktail has a really positive effect. I guess we won't be able to dissect out why.
I mean, you'd literally have to do, because it does look very promising. And since you can't determine what the good and the bad is, you'd have to do the same trial, except have bevacizumab not in one arm and in the other arm to see whether it's contributing.
And what's his quality of life been like on treatment?
Very good. He feels well.
Interesting. Anything else you want to discuss that we haven't talked about today? For example, anything that you get questions about, particularly from medical oncologists in terms of prostate cancer management that we haven't discussed today?
Well, you know, I get a lot of calls about what to do after docetaxel right now. I guess some of the points that I would make is if a patient's had docetaxel, at least right now until abiraterone gets approved or cabazitaxel gets approved, I will treat them with ketoconazole if they haven't had it. I will actually backtrack to that, which a lot of people don't know to do. And I've seen, you know, up to a couple of year long responses to ketoconazole in patients who have progressed on docetaxel and have never had ketoconazole. So I think you've got to remember that androgen is still important and that these patients still may be hypersensitive to low levels of androgen. So I think that's an important thing. And I get questions about what chemotherapy to try. You know, I mean, mitoxantrone was approved for the palliation of bone pain. It did not improve survival overall. But if you actually look at patients that were treated on the global Taxotere versus mitoxantrone trial, when they actually do a sub-analysis of the patients treated with mitoxantrone, patients who were treated with mitoxantrone who do have declines in PSA, you know, significant declines, did have a better survival. So it's not necessarily, you know, a chemotherapy that you need to say, well, that's not going to help my patient. Another regimen that I mentioned when talking about my last patient was this TEC regimen. And there is data out there. There's a recent paper on the value of TEC after docetaxel, and it does clearly produce responses in patients and can improve their quality of life and cause tumor shrinkage. I mean, I have a patient right now who progressed on Taxotere, never responded to Taxotere, and is having a great response. He went from, you know, coming in a wheelchair to he's about to go to the Middle East for a wedding, and he's going away for several weeks because he's had such a good response. He's up, he's working again. So that's a regimen that a lot of people are unaware of as being potentially active after docetaxel. You do have to convince the insurance companies to cover the cost of the carboplatin, but I've been able to do that.
Any sense in terms of how much of the benefit of TEC is from paclitaxel, and what about just paclitaxel itself?
I haven't done just paclitaxel alone. And so, I mean, it's possible that it's a response just to the paclitaxel, but, you know, I think the platinums have an underappreciated activity in prostate cancer.
You know, I've been curious ever since the data came out with docetaxel to what extent it was going to actually be implemented in practice. I mean, you hear about a case like your 70-year-old man, and, you know, it's pretty interesting and provocative that somebody could do so well. Do you have any sense in terms of, do you think that the vast majority of men with metastatic prostate cancer are actually getting to an oncologist? And if they get to an oncologist, are they in general being considered for docetaxel or for chemotherapy?
Yeah, I think right now, as compared to when I first specialized in prostate cancer many years ago, when probably less than 10% of patients ever saw a medical oncologist because we didn't have a lot to offer them, quite frankly, I would say it's now closer to 80 or 85%, a rather large percentage of patients actually get to medical oncologists. And most of those patients at least get offered chemotherapy. You know, a lot of the patients choose not to take it. Not a lot, but some patients. But I think the vast majority of castrate-resistant prostate cancer patients are now being referred to a medical oncologist, sometimes maybe a little later than we'd like, but they are being referred. And I think they're being offered chemotherapy. I wanted to mention something, you know, sort of things that you want to share. And this is just because I get excited about things that happen that I think are really fascinating. And it's just sort of a point that I wanted to get across to people that are listening. Recently, I had a patient with, this is another case, the first case, but I won't go through the whole case. I'll just want to talk about what happened recently to him. This is a gentleman with castrate-resistant prostate cancer who had been treated with, I'd given him, as you said, Casodex as a second-line hormonal therapy and hadn't worked. And I had actually wanted to give him ketoconazole, but he told me he was allergic to it. He had gotten a rash. I actually subsequently found out that that was to topical ketoconazole, not to oral ketoconazole. But while we were deciding what to do, he had this terrible, terrible headache, went to the emergency room and had a subdural hematoma, a rather significant one with a midline shift. He had bumped his head on a kitchen cabinet and he was in DIC. And, you know, we see this in our patients with advanced prostate cancer. It's not an uncommon scenario that these patients have at least a low level of DIC. He had a rather significant case of DIC going on, and the surgeons brought him to the OR. They evacuated this bleeding, and he was very unstable. He was on a ventilator. He was hypotensive. He looked terrible, and they were talking about, you know, just sort of taking him off the ventilator. But I thought, you know, I remember I talked to the wife and she said, oh, it was a cream that he got. And I said, well, you know, he's on a ventilator. I certainly can't cause him to have a respiratory arrest. We're going to give him ketoconazole because there's old literature that almost no one seems to remember that shows that ketoconazole in prostate cancer can reverse DIC relatively quickly. And so his platelet count, which had been in, you know, it was in like 90,000, but he was in DIC. His platelet count, right as soon as we started, within a day, his platelet count was over 100,000. Within a couple of days, his platelet count was, now it's 176,000 yesterday. But his DIC basically reversed. And because of that, they went back in, re-evacuated him. He got off the ventilator. He was complaining that the coffee was bad and is up walking. And this is within a week of starting the ketoconazole and reversing his DIC. It was amazing. I was just flabbergasted.
That's incredible. And I guess so. The DIC is a direct effect of the tumor, correct?
Right, right.
What's the mechanism?
I don't know. You know, I know sometimes they'll have a low level of DIC. It's usually seen in very aggressive prostate cancers, often seen in the anaplastic prostate cancers. I don't know exactly why they have DIC.
That's amazing. How often have you seen patients with prostate cancer in clinical DIC like this?
Not that many, 4 or 5 maybe. It happens that I had 2 patients recently. He's one of them, and another patient with anaplastic prostate cancer who actually presented in DIC and almost died. I also gave him ketoconazole and it reversed his DIC.
Wow. And do you think this is just a straightforward anti-tumor effect of ketoconazole or maybe some kind of metabolic intermediary or something?
You know, I guess I've hypothesized that it just, you know, blocks all of the androgens that, you know, the adrenal androgens are having enough of effect that these, like as I mentioned earlier, these patients may be hypersensitive to low levels of androgen. And if we could just get rid of those. If you talk to urologists, especially urologists who are older, they all remember using ketoconazole when they had a patient come in with very aggressive widespread disease, let's say with a spinal cord compression, you know, where you're trying to rapidly reverse their cancer. And they will tell you that, you know, they have a lot of experience doing this. But most people now, haven't heard of this. Most of the current group of oncologists, you know, are unaware of this potential therapy in a patient in DIC with prostate cancer.
That's incredible. I could imagine there might have been a few raised eyebrows around the ICU with the 70-year-old man intubated and metastatic prostate cancer that you're still, you know, kind of pushing pretty hard on.
Well, his neurosurgeon said, oh, well, you know, what the hoot, let's just do it, which is what the wife said. But it's funny, when I was looking through his chart to document exactly what his platelet count was and everything, just, you know, make sure I was really thinking, you know, they were all talking about how amazing this was. But in his chart, it still was written that the nurse had put in that he was on ketoconazole as an antifungal drug. I don't know, maybe they thought, you know, as he lay there dying on a ventilator, I wanted to treat his athlete's foot. I don't know.